Welcome to the Institutional History Society's Mad, Bad and Bizarre, Part 4.
Your hosts for the day are Daniel Shepherd and Gemma Minter.
We do not have to visit a madhouse to find disordered minds. Our planet is the mental institution of the universe. Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. Before we move on to a list of new inmates, we want to update you on one we spoke about previously. Christopher Wilson, prisoner 226, imprisoned for life for bestiality with a female ass. Since our previous podcast, we found a little more information about him. Unfortunately, none of it exculpating this particularly asinine crime. He left Woking Prison in April of 1863 and was received at Fisherton Asylum in Salisbury. This asylum was one of the first asylums to hold the criminally insane who were deemed not too dangerous. Those who were deemed dangerous would be transferred to Bedlam. And so, to this asylum to wait out the rest of his days went Christopher as a pauper inmate, so called as they were not private patients. Christopher was there for only a year and a half before he died, aged 77. Thieves amongst us. The landlord of the cemetery tavern, Alfred Hurst, was concerned. Twice now he'd seen people trying to break into the post office. The first time the owner, Mrs. Leather, had screamed and scared them away.
Now he was convinced it was the same person at the keyhole. Although there were more than a few of them loitering outside, he tried to fix their faces in his mind, knowing that when the time came for it, he'd have to talk to the police and grass them up.
Another young man, William Johnson, had spotted the suspicious group and had tried to get closer to them.
A woman, noting the man's interest, casually walked away and did not return.
Johnson, not wanting to give himself away, jumped over the wall of the school so he could observe the remaining pair unseen. The insalubrious duo made their way to the back door of the post office, mischief clearly on their minds. Johnson walked towards them, not willing to let this treachery go on any further, and the would-be thieves ambled away.
Johnson walked over to Hurst, and the pair discussed what they'd seen so far and watched the movements of the men, unwilling to let them get out of their sight. They didn't have long to wait. A third man soon joined them, and the trio, now three times braver, secretly wended their way from house to house for over an hour and a half, all the way watched by the dogged eyes of Hurst.
The corrupt triad tried doors along their route, ending with the school, when one of them felt the eyes of the sentinels observing them, and in response, he hopped over the wall into a back street. Hurst had seen enough. Hurst and Johnston found the local policeman, a man named Sharp, and the threesome sought out the would-be criminals. Sometime later, they discovered them accidentally by Hurst's own public house. The offenders, recognizing Hurst from their previous aborted attempts, made a vile remark to him. The fight that followed was vicious. Both the policeman and the landlord Hurst were struck and fell to the ground. Eventually, despite being outnumbered, Hurst and Sharp wrangled the three felons into the local police station. John Hardwick, Henry Lee, and Uriah Walls were the names given. They were all implicated in the actions of that night. Unbeknownst to the landlord, they had also been involved in another crime.
A week before, a jeweller had been accosted viciously and several items removed from his possession. A servant girl had watched the entire event from an upper window and had ascertained that they were the same three involved.
And so the triad were taken before the bench to plead their case. Interestingly, the magistrates decided not to pass a ruling on both crimes at the same time, but only upon the attempted robbery spotted by Johnson and Hurst that day.
The judge decreed that the hoodlums would receive 3 months for intending to commit robbery. The mayor, one of the magistrates, implored the police to use this time to cement the case against the men for the attack.
3 months later, they faced the bench at York. Lee was not convicted, but both Walls and Hardwick would be sentenced to a further 14 years for the jewellery theft. 7 years later, Uriah would die in Woking Prison, having served half of his sentence with fair behaviour throughout, but never to be a free man again.
The Ash Flats murder. When we leafed through the information pertaining to this crime, we were horrified. We've had multiple instances of spousal abuse and many vile incidental murders that were, from the evidence available, crimes of passion. We've had attacks, bestiality, and theft. But this is the first time that we have seen premeditated and brutal double homicides for monetary gain.
So far. Our convict, a man found guilty and originally sentenced to hang, is Edward Walsh. But the circumstances surrounding his crime are confusing. The truth is still not fully known. Did he deserve his sentence? Is this a terrible miscarriage of justice?
You'll have to decide that for yourself.
October 1852. The sun rose lugubriously in the sky. Birdsong punctuated the air, and very shortly after, at around 8 a.m, an alarm was raised. A cottage on the road to Wolverhampton was ablaze. Fire engines were sent for, but they could not ascend the two sets of stairs to check for survivors until the flames had been quenched and the smoke cleared. The house itself was a strange construction. At one time it had been two separate cottages, but were later joined and owned by the elderly Blackburns. Their bedrooms were reached by two different staircases from the ground floor, and although married, they had long been in the habit of sleeping apart. So it was more than a little odd that when the rescuers ascended the stairs, they found both John and Jane Blackburn in the same room, dead. This was no accident. John Blackburn's torso was completely burnt. His head, however, showed distinct damage. It was fractured across the facial bones with a deep shearing gash across the back of the skull.
Jane's corpse also reiterated that this was no accidental death from an unmasked flame. Whilst the fire had destroyed her arms and legs, her blackened torso and head remained with the telltale marks of blunt force trauma to the skull. Blood pooling at the base of the stairs to Mr. Blackburn's room showed that he had likely been murdered there, and a similar mark at the base of Mrs. Blackburn's stairs pointed to her death location also. It was reasoned that the pair were bludgeoned. They were moved to the master bedroom and set ablaze to hide the true cause of death.
The police eventually found the dog killed in a similar manner, dumped into the well, no doubt to prevent his warning the occupants. To note, the dog wasn't theirs, and they had borrowed it for their protection from one of their own children, Henry Blackburn. Continuing their sickening search in the well, the constables found an axe also, the weapon that had almost certainly caused the fatal blows to the Blackburns. So horrified were they by the discovery of the geriatric couple and their slaughtered canine that they themselves offered a reward for information about the culprit. The reward was of between £5 and £100, dependent upon the depth of information, and the government offered a further 50. Public indignation was at fever pitch, and condemnation widespread. The authorities reasoned that a crime this brutal could not have been committed without the murderer leaving some mark, and that someone must have seen something. That same night, the police arrested Henry Blackburn, youngest son of the pair, and the boy who had lent them his own, now deceased, guard dog. Henry proclaimed his innocence. They were his parents, for goodness sake. And aside from visiting them fairly frequently, his common law wife definitely did not think it could have been him. But one of the Blackburns' employees, Charles Moore, was sure he had seen the man walk away from the cottage that morning. Things were quiet for 3 days, and then, in a surprising turn of events, anonymous letters started to arrive at the local police station advising them to look at a different Blackburn's son. They were initially hesitant to believe these missives. Why would someone send anonymous letters when there was a reward on offer?
Another letter arrived, and the police became curious. This anonymous Good Samaritan knew far more about the crimes than had been shared with the press. Indeed, more than any benign witness should know. The writer had to have been involved. Unsure of how to reach out to him, the police called their only solid witness, Charles Moore. He was questioned intensely, his answers becoming more and more confused as the police walked him through the events of the morning over and over again. Eventually, Moore wrote a full statement at home and returned it to them in the next day or so. It's not known if this was suggested by the police or Moore himself. Either way, the results were very, very telling.
The statement he wrote was compared to the anonymous missives. The handwriting was a match. Moore's house was searched and they found the same type of matches, Lucifer matches, that were used to start the blaze at the Ash Flats. More damning still, a coat of Moore's was found to be made of the same red wool as a remnant found on the fastening of the kitchen.
The wool, I feel, is incredibly significant, but not incontrovertible proof of murder. Whilst all clothing was hand-dyed, and being handmade it was easily recognisable by fibre, Moore worked for the Blackburns, and thus his clothing may have got there previously. There is no report as to where in the kitchen this fibre was found, and no proof regarding how long it had been there.
The house was reportedly in a state of serious disrepair. Moore could have accidentally left the fibres on any other visit to their abode, so whilst proof that he had been in the building, it was not proof of murder. So why did he write the letters? And did Moore have a motive? A reason to stave in the heads of the two elderly people and attempt to destroy them with fire? Suddenly, the police were on the warpath, and everyone connected to Moore was suspect.
His partner Catherine Walsh's father, Edward, had recently burnt his hands also. It was circumstantial evidence at best in an age of candles and open flames, but he too was arrested. Moore was implicating everyone around him, and by virtue of association and his word, another man, Peter Kirwan, was arrested due to his testimony. It appeared that he was trying to obfuscate the real culprit by damning many.
So by the time that the case stood before a jury 5 months later, in March of 1853, four men stood accused of this barbarous crime. Moore and the three men he had accused, Peter Kirwan, Edward Walsh, and Henry Blackburn, youngest son of the two dead victims, all went to trial. Peter, first before the bench, was dismissed. The judge, no doubt a little unimpressed, decreed that as there is no evidence aside from the word of a potential murderer, that the jury should find him not guilty. And so, he was released. Blackburn was next. Moore claimed that he and the others had been paid by Blackburn to end the lives of his parents. The inference was that the butchery of the dog had been his doing, as no doubt it would have followed his master home.
A man who had been in the area around the time of the murder gave a statement that Blackburn had not been seen on the property. His partner, Maria Rochell, had stated before that he'd been at home with her all through the night. She gave this statement before knowing murders had been committed. Her testimony, however, was brought into stern question, as the pair were unmarried, and unmarried women who lived with a man and bore his children could not be trusted. The judge then addressed the jury, stating,
"Mercy on their part would consist of taking care that the accused should not be convicted except on perfectly clear evidence."
The jury discussed, but an hour later Henry too was found not guilty and released back into a community that had thought him capable of parricide, the killing of a parent, twice over.
Walsh and Moore now faced the dock.
The speculation at the time was that John and Jane Blackburn had acquired some of the famed Tutbury hoard, and this fantastical wealth had been hidden in their home. But as there is little evidence of this, we cannot be sure.
What is known is that the pair were significantly wealthier than their neighbours. Despite the rundown farmhouse, they owned 52 acres of freehold, and their finances were healthy, if not amazingly so. Moore and Walsh were accused of cold-blooded murder for monetary gain and were found guilty. Supposedly, after being led away before their sentencing, they admitted this guilt. But here is where the tale takes a twist.
The pair were sentenced to death by hanging, and so were granted the comforts of religious support. Moore took as much time with the clerics as he could, and eventually wrote a full confession. A confession which entirely exonerated Walsh.
I did not see Walsh that afternoon. Between 11 and 12 o'clock that night, I left my house by myself. I met nobody that I knew. I went back to the Ash Flats. The house was shut up. I went into the house through the window by the door. All that was done in it was done by myself. There was no one else in it. All that I said about Henry Blackburn giving the money was not true. I ask forgiveness from all the people for the untruths which I have said about them. I said what I did to throw the blame off my shoulders. I declined stating how the deed was done, as it was too painful and is publicly known. I will say that there were no combustible matters used to hasten the burning of the bodies, such as resin and the like things. I acknowledge the justice of my sentence, and I ask pardon of the Almighty God for the great offence I have committed, and also of all the persons whom I have implicated in the matter. Signed, Charles Moore. In the presence of A.C. Talbot, Visiting Magistrate, Edward Huddleston, J. O'Sullivan, and W. Fulford, Governor of the Jail.
Walsh had been indebted to Moore, and so was assumed to be party to the foul deed. But he had a solid alibi, in that of Peter Kirwan and his family, for the night before the murder, and no legal counsel until halfway through the trial. On the days leading up to the hanging of Moore, Walsh was granted a respite by the Secretary of State.
He continued to appeal, but after this brief flurry of kindness, Walsh was left to rot, serving a life sentence for a crime he apparently didn't commit. 16 years later, he was released from Woking Prison, an infirm man, aged 81, with a spotless behavioural record throughout his time in the prison system. Did the court fail him, or did he take part in the murder of a helpless couple? The jury is still out on this one. Thank you for listening to the Institutional History Society's Mad, Bad and Bizarre Part 4. We couldn't have got this far without the London Archives, the British Library and the Woking Lightbox.
Special thanks to Kevin MacLeod for the use of his music on our podcast. Any comments, requests or feedback, please send through to our email, institutionalhistory@gmail.com. To find out more, sign up to our monthly newsletter on our website, institutionalhistory.com.